and welcome to Cult Movie Cult, where we watch and discuss the horrific, the obscure, and the flat-out strange from the other side of cinema. I'm Mark Dickerson.
And I'm Jeremy Fink, and this is a special one-off episode where we'll be discussing Robot Monster from 1953. Robot Monster tells the story of the alien named Roman from the planet Roman, who has come to Earth to destroy all humans. The film focuses on his efforts to destroy the last 8 remaining humans who have developed an immunity to his method of attack.
Of a deadly cosmic ray, the Earth is invaded by indestructible moon monsters. Their ghastly mission, death for all humans. What astounding technical developments are being made to protect mankind? Robot Monster brings you an actual preview of the devastating forces of our future. Unsuspected revelations of incredible horrors that will terrify you with their brutal reality.
There is no escape from me. Very well. I will recalculate. Your death will be indescribable. Fool humans, there is no escape.
Not only that, but we have a guest today on the show. So joining us today is Marley Starr. So thank you very much. Yes, thank you for being here and for actually telling us about this film, exposing us to Robot Monster.
Plaguing you with him.
Yes, exactly. Because both Jeremy and I had no idea this movie existed. Which I was like, shocked because it's from the 50s. And I just, it's an era that I think we both kind of love. And we did a series on the show from about 50s atomic monster movies and things like that. So, once I watched the trailer, I was like, yep, we need to do an episode on that. And Marley needs to be on it. So I'm glad you agreed to it.
Yeah. Well, this movie is definitely from the bowels of Hollywood. It's one of those extremely wonderful low budget movies from, I guess, like a period of film where people nowadays, when they think low budget movies, they think like stuff made nowadays with a camcorder from 2011. Mm-hmm. But lower budget movies from the 50s have that very distinct charm where you can tell this was shot within probably a week and it's in the middle of the desert and these costumes are so old and sweaty and it's just it's so insanely fun to watch. I'm glad that I can expose more people to my best friend Roman.
Oh, it's right up my alley, and Jeremy as well, as I imagine. So I'm very glad that I got to see it. Like you said, you don't see many low budget films from that time period. You see lower budget, but not this low budget.
You see B movies, but you don't see so many like DIY movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, this is like an F movie. This is really working its way down the line.
Yeah. I mean, this one gives Ed Wood himself a run for his money, I would even say, which is saying something. But it's also always exciting going into a movie knowing absolutely nothing about it. Mm-hmm. So that was just fun in general, which we do sometimes on the show. And this one is also a lean 62 minutes, mm-hmm. which was kind of nice. It was like,
yes,
I felt like I sat down to watch it and it was basically over.
Kind of common for that time, though, I feel like. I feel like this is not the first one of these kind of 50 B movies where, which I kind of missed that a little bit. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I say miss it like I was around back then, but like, you know, I feel like there's kind of something nice about a movie that's just like, it's enough where you go on a full kind of journey with the characters, but mm-hmm. it's also very bite-sized. There's something kind of fun about that length.
Oh, definitely.
Something I noticed is that it felt like a best hits compilation of a better movie. Like someone edited down all the action scenes. Well, I wouldn't say action, maybe like lumbering around the desert scenes, but like someone edited down what felt like a much longer odyssey that maybe mm-hmm. had some better moments in it, but mm-hmm. was still like a made for TV edit. That's kind of what it felt like, but that's just the final product.
That is true. Yeah. It does feel like that. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm always a fan of shorter films in general. So just like really quick, like entertaining, you know. And I mean, obviously, it was probably for budgetary reasons as well. It's so short, but, you know, it works for this film. I don't know if it could have dragged on much longer with
the premise that
it had. So I did. So right off the bat, I wanted to talk about actually the music, because it kind of that intro score like really struck. I don't know if it's because I was using headphones to watch it, but it just really struck me. And apparently, the composer is quite famous.
I caught that actually. Elmer Bernstein, correct?
Elmer Bernstein. Yeah,
I caught it because people are never named Elmer these days. Yeah. Oh, what a name.
Yeah, exactly.
I saw his name and I was like, I don't know what he's done, but I know that name. Like, I've definitely seen
you
that.
You know,
like,
Elmer.
So,
well, he did Cat Women of the Moon same year. But I mean, but then he did a lot of very prestigious films like The Great Escape, Magnificent Seven, Ten Commandments. He did Thriller, the music video. I guess he was part of that. And Ghostbusters of all movies. So yeah, he went on to have an all right career.
That's pretty good.
That's not bad. Yeah,
and
he stayed within the macabre. I can tell.
Yes, he did. And yeah, I guess maybe I don't know if he got a start on this film or it was pretty early on, but the music did stand out to me. The sound design in general actually stood out to me, and because they did some interesting things with it. And apparently, this is considered the first science fiction film with stereophonic sound. So, I mean, that's, yeah, I mean, so it's, there you go. Not only is it entertaining to watch, it's a historically important film.
So I'm actually, not to jump around and harp on the music too much, but I'm seeing that he actually, so this was like the fifth or sixth movie that he did. And he actually, before this movie, had done the movie Sudden Fear with Joan Crawford. So it wasn't was like a nobody when he did this movie. Like he had done at least one, you know.
Well,
I mean, Joan Crawford was a pretty big star at that point. Like,
yeah,
for sure.
I was reading some information about it, and the way he spoke about it was kind of like, oh, it was like a fun one-off project, you know. Like, it was nice to help these guys out, like making a movie and everything. So I think he was just part of the spirit of all of it, I guess, which is pretty cool. But, yeah, it came out really well and added a lot to it. And so just to get into the film a little bit, we begin with little Johnny and his sister Carla. They're kind of running around playing, I guess, spaceman or something like that. And we are also introduced to the professor, who is only known as the professor.
Yes.
which reminded me of Gilligan's Island.
Mm-hmm.
And his assistant Roy in a leather jacket.
Yes, perfectly coiffed Roy, who stays that way the entire movie. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, the man meat of the movie. we'll talk about that more later.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, so the eye candy there. And then we also have Alice. And so I guess
it's other eye candy.
Yeah, the other eye candy in the film. And her father is a professor. Then we have her mother as well. And at first I wasn't sure the relation everyone had to each other. It was a little confusing. But you start, you know, you eventually get it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do have a note to pin in that, something I picked up on, like, my second watch. But after the little plot summary, I'll get into it. Because it is very confusing for no reason.
Yes, for no reason at all.
Yeah.
We have the professor, and he's sort of like a knockoff Bela Lugosi kind of vibe. Like, I don't know. That was kind of how I felt. I don't know. Not in a bad way. I love Bela Lugosi, so. But he was like, you know. Kind of had that vibe going. Yeah. And then I have a note here that just says iguanas fighting ?
Yeah,
because I wasn't sure what to make of that, which happens very early on in the film. We see this imagery which they return to actually later on in the film.
Yes,
and it's awesome, and it's just awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, it's great. Yeah.
Jeremy. I do believe that was an alligator with a triceratops flap.
That's what I thought too. Yeah.
Was it?
I think it is.
Wow.
I recently was in Florida, and they had a bunch of small alligators nearby the place I was staying, and I was like, that looks like a little tiny alligator to me.
So, yeah, it does.
I'm not sure where I got iguana from.
Because it was
fighting an iguana, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah, it was doing a death roll.
Yeah, it was doing the death roll. That's why I was like, this is insane footage. Like, they fully had an alligator kill another animal. Like, that was ridiculous. Was like,
it was psychedelic. And like Jeremy said, when we were talking before we started recording, he's like, I could watch an hour just of that foot, like of that kind of,
for sure.
You know, not that specifically, but like that kind of,
like if this had come out in 1968 and was like some guys riding around on motorcycles and like 30 minutes of that footage, it for sure would have been like a successful Roger Corman film. Absolutely.
Oh, that for sure. Been
yeah, for sure.
For it would
sure.
Have been. That's awesome.
Yeah.
So yeah, we have that. And then, from there, Robo-Man himself emerges. Ro-Man,
yes.
As he's called in the film. Mm-hmm. And how do we describe the costume? I mean, how do we... So it's sort of like a gorilla suit. Well, it is a gorilla suit. Mm-hmm. With a spaceman-type helmet with antenna sticking out of it. Now, why is he a gorilla? Was that the only costume they had lying around? That was my first thought. Apparently, the costume I found out later was actually made for the film, which is very
really
interesting. Yes.
The helmet, I can believe. The gorilla suit, I'm pretty sure they just got that in the 50s equivalent of a Party City.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Something like that. That's
it.
What
did
I thought,
it did have a kind of like metallic, at least in the black and white photography, looked to me metallic, like chest piece. Like it was definitely harder. That didn't look too gorilla. At least to me, it looked like it was something kind of more like some kind of armor of sorts. But I also could be, I did not feel this costume. I could be misjudging that. It could be fleshy. I'm not sure.
It did have nipples for some reason.
It did have
nipples.
Which
I did know.
Yes. The nipples were crucial to the whole ambiance. George Barrows, who played Roman, apparently did make according to Wikipedia, he made the costume for the film. So yeah, it's very interesting. And I also want to take a moment, we often do this on the show, usually Jeremy brings it up, but I want to talk about the poster for this movie.
Okay.
Just briefly, because it's sort of like, because it looks different, a bit different on the poster itself, and the poster itself is kind of like haunting. Like the imagery on it is, it's the same suit but with it's like an additional illustration or artwork over the, well, Marley, you would know, over the. We actually forgot to mention our collaboration, which we should probably.
Oh yeah, we just barreled right into it. I'm so sorry.
I was so excited to talk about this movie.
Me too.
But we'll definitely talk about it, our collaboration as well. But on the poster, it has this like artwork over the dome of the space helmet of like the skull-like face. Whereas in the movie, it's sort of like indistinct. It looks almost like he has a something over his face, like a
gray sock,
like a stocking or something. Yeah. Something
yeah.
Like that. Even the iguana made it onto the poster, by the way.
Yes.
In 3D.
In 3D. Well, I actually have a really great note about the 3D component.
Yes, please,
of this.
Because this was released in 3D.
Yes, this was released in like the 1950s version of 3D, which was achieved in a way different way than it is now. Like when people see 3D movies now, the most that they think of is just putting on the funny glasses and hey, now it's looking out, it's gonna touch me. Whoa,
right.
Spy Kids, the coins are jumping out of my face, like that kind of thing. That's, I mean, that's the most 3D movie that ever. 3D.
I love that you mentioned that one. Yes, that's great.
Oh yeah, but well,
your millennial is showing.
Would you believe I'm Gen Z? Actually,
oh, really?
Sorry, I'm younger.
And you've seen Spy.
Sorry,
it's true.
I'm so sorry. I was born in a year that starts with the number 2.
Oh,
I'm so
wow.
sorry. But
we just feel old now. That's all.
Yeah. Gotcha. I'm sorry. But either way, 3D movies in that era were presented in a much different way. Mm-hmm. They were done by having two screens that were projected diagonally at each other so that when you put on the glasses, they had that effect. And it wasn't anything within like the data of the film. Granted, I'm not too well read on how 3D is achieved today, but I've been to a screening of this where the 3D was done how it was done in the past with those two screens on like in each corner of the room diagonally hitting each other in the middle.
That
it's
is really cool.
Super interesting.
That
and
is,
it's actually it's actually how I found out about this movie because Bayview Entertainment, they restore old 3D films into more accessible modern 3D. And that screening I went to at like a Dolby Theater in New York was just happening to be this movie. And I talked to the people who are starting a project we'll talk about later,
yes.
Foreshadowing.
But which is very exciting.
That 3D was a huge selling point and even is to this day.
That's kind of interesting that you mentioned the two. I'm just thinking of, I don't know if either of you are familiar with, there's a little kind of tool, for lack of a better term, but an early kind of photographic tool called a stereograph. Have either of you ever tinkered with this?
Mm-hmm. I've heard of it, yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of similar. It's basically, it's kind of a little, like a mask you wear, basically. I picked one up years ago. I found it at like a thrift store or something.
Oh, okay.
But basically it's the same thing where it's a little mask with a stick and that sticks out kind of from the nose, almost like a witch doctor mask. And you put a picture, but they're like specially made, but it's really two pictures that are right next to each other. And you put these two pictures on the end of the stick and you look at it, and by sliding the mask forward and back, you can put it into focus. I actually think there's one in the movie Django Unchained, if I remember correctly. Either that or I just invented this in my brain. But it's actually a pretty astounding effect. Like, it was invented in the late 1800s or maybe even mid-1800s. And it's a pretty astounding effect. Like, when you see it, it's kind of hard to believe that something that's just kind of so, you know, rickety, it's like a little wooden thing, produces such an amazing visual. But I'm imagining it's probably some kind of
something
the
like
two screen thing is kind of similar. So I don't know.
Right.
I didn't know that that's how they did that back then. So I'm actually curious to do some more research now.
We're learning.
That's really cool.
Look at this.
I like that.
Yes,
we're learning
great.
A lot today, kids.
Well, you're very intimately involved with this film. We're gonna discuss it after we discuss the film itself. But
yes.
I do want to kind of hint at it a bit, because it is very exciting, the project you're a part of. But anyway, we will definitely discuss that. And Jeremy, I want one of those that you mentioned.
You could probably find one pretty inexpensively, I'd imagine.
Really?
And they sell the cards. You know, there's still plenty of those cards kicking around. A friend of mine got me a few of them as like a birthday gift a few years ago. So I would recommend it. It's a pretty fun little thing to have on deck.
The most I had was like one of those viewfinder things, which was nothing
like
that at all.
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, you know what I'm talking about. So I'm not that old, right? No, definitely.
No, I have these things. I know what you're talking about.
Polaroids, do you remember those? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I have a Polaroid camera sitting on my desk right now.
See, everything comes back. That's great.
That's true. To be fair, I got it at like a mall in like 2015.
Oh, yeah,
so
of course.
It's not authentic.
It's okay. It still counts. So just getting back into the film a little bit. So we're still in the beginning of the film, but we do learn quite early on that due to a miscalculation error on the part of the conquering aliens regarding their death ray, there are 8 people left on planet Earth. Or 6. Well, there's 8, but... So for a while, I was like, there's 6, right? Like, I was like, so they got that wrong. There's only 6. But there's actually 2, so we actually never see them in the film, I don't believe, but there's 2 other humans still alive.
Who man. That's, I love that. Big fan of the way he pronounces that.
Oh, that's, I cracked up every time. but yeah, there's 8 humans left on planet Earth, and Roman must destroy them. He must destroy all of them. As he's told by his great guidance, the great guidance himself, who is another gorilla man / robot.
Yes.
And it's also, I mean, this whole thing just struck me. We talk a lot on the show about low budget ideas, obviously, because we talk about cult films. But we talk about, you know, filmmaking from the perspective of low budget filmmaking. And this is a brilliant, like sort of like a perfect low budget idea for a sci-fi film.
Oh, yeah,
at least I thought so, because you don't need many actors or locations. You know, if these are going to be the last 8 people on Earth, then, you know, you only need 8 actors, and you need, well, actually not even 8 actors.
Six,
I guess you
six
only
actors.
Need, you need 6.
although technically 2 actors as the row men.
As the row. Well, actually,
sure, one
or was
guy.
It just one?
Yeah,
or
that.
One,
yeah, I just
both?
I just read that as well. That was played by the same.
Well, the he got me. The perform. I thought it was 2. So. It, you know.
It was so moving.
Yeah.
Yes. I know that performance is we'll talk
really
about
effective.
It. Yes. The way he pronounced humans is
there's odd, weird gestures, and you can really tell I was laughing.
He really
ADR.
Emotes. He does,
he does
really emote. And also, he really speaks a lot. He has a lot of dialogue. That was another thing I wanted to, like, something that, you know, I thought he was just going to be this lumbering, I mean, which he is a lumbering monster.
He was.
Yeah, he definitely is that, but he also Has a lot of dialogue, speaks a lot in the film.
Oh, yeah. He has a great monologue towards the end, which we'll
he
get
does.
To.
Oh, mm-hmm. I love that monologue, yes. we'll definitely discuss that. And the humans, I guess they live, this is sort of not really well-defined, or maybe I just misinterpreted it, but the humans live within this sort of barrier where Roman cannot detect them, or did I totally make that up? That might have been made up.
Marley, it's hard you would probably to tell.
Know. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's the thing. The way I interpret this movie, I guarantee, is not how it's written.
There are many ways to interpret this film.
Oh, my God. It's such a unique piece of art in the way that, like, you can... And I mean that both in a way that's, like, ironic, like The Room, but also kind of genuinely, that, like, there's ways you can derive enjoyment from this. So I think half of my enjoyment was me trying to piece together what the hell this plot was. what I got from it initially was that Roman was broadcasting just kind of blindly to any screen he could. I don't know if this was the future. They have mentioned space platforms before, so I'm guessing this is already the future, and then it was conquered.
See, they knew that there were going to be screens everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I do love how in the 50s or like whatever past, you know, what an old media that's trying to depict what the future would look like. They got the FaceTime thing correct, but it's always like, let's go to the communication room. And everyone has to pile into this tiny little room with one screen. Like, you're so close. You just forgot the part that we could put it everywhere.
We don't need a room. Yeah.
Yeah.
You can.
I think it just takes place in, like, that small window before there was video chatting on laptops, and you could, like, only do it on the PC in your home. We very briefly our culture had the communications room.
Also, they were probably like, we have the set, so let's use it for something.
We have a big wood panel. Let's slap his face on there.
Well, we also, there is also the challenge of, you know, like, they have the set, but also just, you know, moving around and, you know, setting them up in other places where they could actually do some kind of projection as a crew, you know, or I'm not sure how they pulled off the effect, whether it was like a kind of a double exposure type of thing, or if they were doing some kind of rear screen projection or something like that. I'm not exactly sure, but I would imagine that also probably limited them to that one location.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are lots of different techniques at play. Like, they use stock footage.
Frequently.
Another Ed Wood technique, you know.
Yeah.
Learn from the master there. Actually, this is probably before all that. So, it's interesting, like all the different techniques that are involved. But sorry, Marley, you were about to say something there.
I don't want to interrupt. I just, during this scene where Roman does have this little FaceTime call with the family, he has a great line where he says, quote, "You must kill yourselves."
You must. He's like pleading with them. Like, you must.
Like, come on, guys. Please.
Just do it. Come on. It'd be so much easier if you guys would just do that. Yeah.
Well, there's a few moments that had me laughing. Like, earlier in the film, they say, like, dialing back a little bit. I don't want to throw off the pacing
please.
Retelling it.
By all
means,
that's what we do here.
Earlier, when the older sister, the mother, I forget who, but, like, one of them says, like, oh, we have to have lunch, and then you nap after lunch. And they're all sitting at the picnic, and then it fades to black, and then it comes back in, and they're all just passed out in the field.
I forgot about that. Oh, my God.
They're just dead. They're not dead. They're obviously asleep, but it just looked – in the context of
just
this alien
out,
film, it feels like they all just died. It's so many jarring, like, choices here.
Which wouldn't be that absurd later, if that actually happened in the film, because there is so many strange things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So, another thing I put a pin in earlier. You said that the scientist is the father, maybe?
The professor,
I don't think that's true. Only because while they were having lunch or, like, having a little picnic, the kid says something like, "Are we going to get a new dad?" Something, something, something.
Oh, you're
like,
right.
So in this what I got, I don't want to, like, jump too far to the end, because I guess maybe this is a reveal, but there is a semi-explanation for why these things are different and why all the ladies are suddenly wearing halter tops.
Yeah. Well, and always,
they
can
only afford that.
As always, full spoilers ahead. So,
watch the movie first, folks.
Yes, please.
Things will come up from this point forward.
Please.
From this point forward, we may jump right to the end. So you've been warned.
Okay. Yeah, you never know on this show how we're gonna go.
Gotcha. It's an element of surprise.
Exactly. So yeah, there's a lot of so many strange things. Much of it is romance dialogue. I mean, much of it is quite hilarious, I thought. I just wrote down some quotes, like, as I was watching. I would just, like, write random quotes, but "Fool humans, there is no escape." That was one. "Do you wonder what happened to your fellows? Watch them." And then he was, like, pointed to a screen, and there are lots of screens. Lots of screens in the movie.
It's like America's Funniest Home Videos.
Yes,
just
watch
cuts
this.
Cuts to footage.
And now this.
After these messages.
Yeah, exactly. And it shows, like, this utter destruction and carnage. Like, he just randomly has this footage that he can show them. And then, of course, we have the guidance from the Great One, which we touched on a little bit. But he has some pretty good lines, too. And he's, like, one of the lines I wrote down was, "You sound like Hugh-man, not a Roman."
Yeah.
there was one thing with him I wrote down where he was talking to the Roman on Earth, and he kind of just started going, like, "Fact, you have captured the girl and destroyed her." Fact. And he just, like, fact. I really like that's a very persuasive way of speaking. You just list your facts.
Yeah.
Like, I like that.
You can't argue with that. That's one.
You can't. It's a fact.
Absolutely.
It's a fact. It's a list of facts.
Exactly. It's a list of facts.
Like, what are you going to say to that, you know?
Life hack to win every argument.
Exactly.
Talk like Roman.
Exactly. So the humans need to get word to the space platform and the garrison there that they are still alive. So how are they still alive? And again, it's because of that miscalculation that I mentioned earlier. Not sure what the miscalculation was, but it was pretty severe, I guess. If it left these eight humans left. We also see some miniature work as well. So in addition to, elements like the footage or the reused footage and things like that, we also have some miniature work, which I believe in itself was reused footage, stock footage or something like that from another film, of the space shuttle blowing up. So once the space shuttle blows up, now there are six people left.
Yes.
So yeah, there was two humans on the space shuttle that exploded.
The miniature work for the space shuttle was fantastic because it cuts from real actual footage of what looks like a rocket going into the air, and then it cuts to a tiny little toy airplane that is making airplane sounds in space with a little sparkler on the back. It was adorable.
It was really adorable. You're right.
Yeah, but kind of devastating.
I think
it
got
though.
One of the biggest laughs.
And also
it was horrifying.
A little devastating though, like, because you don't know these guys, and you kind of realize that they've basically
you've never even met them.
They've
and
kind
you're
of just
never
been
going to.
Thrown under
and you're
the bus.
Never going.
Yeah, you're never going to. They just
Yep. Bye.
Although, do they? Because Jeremy, you joked about this, but I'm actually jumping ahead to the very end of the movie now. Mm-hmm. Do they show up at the end? Are they in the end? Because I actually genuinely can't remember.
Nope. It is that one cast the entire movie.
Okay.
Yeah. No, I don't think so.
Good to know.
Yeah.
I think
there's just a couple of guys flying around and.
And they are
viciously murdered. Yeah.
And they're viciously and they are dead now. Okay.
Bye. Yeah.
Yeah. So at this point in the film, Roman wants to meet with Alice. And
falls in love.
Yes, very much falls in love with Alice. I mean, who wouldn't? She's so adorable. We also have Johnny again, where he reveals to Roman that they have injected themselves with an antibiotic serum to counteract the alien death ray, I guess.
With very little prodding on the part of Roman.
Yes. Yeah, I know. He kind of just comes right out with it.
Yeah.
It's like, Johnny, what are you doing? Come on, man. But yeah, so he tells Roman that. And so now Roman, once he learns this, he now must use physical means to eliminate the humans. Which is kind of where the rest of the film goes, where he does turn into a little bit of that lumbering monster that sort of stalking them. Yeah.
His odd T-Rex arms, which definitely was not a creative choice. I think the costume was just that uncomfortable.
Most likely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, would make sense. And then now we mentioned this earlier, but you do get some eye candy here with Roy.
Roy.
So he's, taking his shirt off, wiping his body for no reason.
High pants, hairy chest.
As they're walking.
A shirt I must mention that, earlier in the film, he's like Alice alludes to him having maybe possibly died or gone missing. And she's like, I fell in love with that darn stupid, stubborn, blah, 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 blah. You know, it's 50
already,
people talk.
Yeah, they already fell in love at that point.
And then, yeah, so no emotional work that needs to be done here. They're already in love. So he hops the fence and he's like, hey, I'm alive. And he is still perfectly coiffed.
Oh, yeah.
He looks great. His hair and his shirt has one little baby tear right across where his appendix would be. Everything else looks fine. He's like, I just got back from the desert, apparently. And his hair has just been gelled 5 minutes ago. It's wonderful.
Yep. Chiseled features and all.
yeah.
And then we have this wonderful love scene right in the middle of
Roman
stalking them and trying to kill them.
It has this delightful, like, soft music, and it keeps cutting. This is one of the moments that got the biggest laugh. My friend and I watched it, and we are those who talk during movies. Mm-hmm. And this one had us just cry laughing the whole time, where it would cut between Alice and Roy just chatting and smooching and making very fake conversation, which you can tell was just the actors pointing
extremely
and then being like,
fake.
Look over there. Mm-hmm. And then it would have this delightful music and then instantly cut to Roman lumbering through the desert with like the soundtrack, blah, blah, and then back to the romance and the flutes and then back to him.
Yep.
And it was so, it
was
so
almost,
funny.
It's almost done and like, it almost seems like they knew what they were doing with those,
those
cuts. Like, because they're literally necking in the bushes, and then it keeps cutting back to Roman stalking around looking for them. And actually, it fades out while they're necking. So maybe,
so
I don't know, maybe
implied.
Maybe they were doing something even more. I don't know.
Oh, that's totally how I read it. Because when they got back, the mother, like, or someone was like, where have you two been? And the mother was like, you know where they've been. Or something along those lines.
Say that. You're right.
And then they're like, we're getting married. So
Alice and I want to get married right after.
It's the 50s.
I think like everyone knew exactly what they were doing and was just completely cool with it, and even given the circumstances.
I was 5 second rule. If we get married in the same day, it's not premarital sex.
Yeah, exactly.
It doesn't count. Yeah.
Like, also, he came back without a shirt on.
Yeah, still.
Like, he was still shirtless coming back to meet this girl's mother.
Yeah.
Or see hang out with the girl's mother and tell her that he wants to marry her daughter.
Yeah.
Does he wear a shirt for the rest of the movie? I can't remember.
I think he puts it back on at some point, but he was definitely not.
Well, for the wedding.
Yeah.
For the wedding, yeah.
No, the wedding, he was shirtless.
Wait,
I took note
was
of
he?
That. Yes.
Oh, my God. Yes. Yes, I wrote that
bush.
In my notes as well. He was. Yeah.
Yes, his chest bush was just out and proud while he was getting married.
Yes.
Well.
It's beautiful. What a beautiful day.
Yeah. Wow.
I mean, it was hot out there.
Beautiful ceremony. Yeah.
Surprisingly really good monologue from the father.
Yeah.
Like, that was a genuinely good, effective moment during the wedding. Mm-hmm. I like that.
I mean, they talk about the human spirit in dark times, triumph over evil and things like that.
It hits. It's a pretty good moment.
It definitely hits. And Roy is still shirtless, for sure. and great timing. Just, I don't know, the whole thing was just hilarious. Harry came back and was like, we're getting married now. It's like, we don't have anything else to worry about right now.
Got nothing
okay,
else to do.
Sure. I mean, I guess because of the premarital sex, like you said. So at this point, after the beautiful wedding ceremony and the great speech, Roman strangles the kid's sister. Yikes. I was not prepared for that.
But like bravo for them for taking the risk, though, you know?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Big, yeah.
That's really bold filmmaking. That's incredibly bold.
Horror movies today won't kill kids.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's a line a lot of people don't want to cross, so hats off to them.
Yeah.
Not saying killing kids is a thing to applaud, but I mean...
Yeah, wait a second. What are you...
Taking the extra mile to let their movie be a movie, you know?
Exactly. Because that's what Roman would do, you know?
Yeah. When you're concerned with realism...
He wants to destroy every human.
Yeah.
And I'm surprised it took him this long to figure out that people can be strangled, because for a while he would.
Kids are really easy to strangle. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, well, yeah.
I think that what it comes down to is when you are a Roman and you don't have a neck, it is hard to understand how neck havers could die.
That's true.
You know?
That's so true.
Very true.
I never thought of that.
Yeah.
Very true.
Like, he has a metal neck. You couldn't strangle a Roman. That's not how they die.
Yeah.
You could not. Yeah, you're right.
But I'm worried he didn't have the courage, because he spent the majority of, like, the first half of the movie just in his cave, and he'd walk out, he'd do a little FaceTime, go back in the cave, and then come back out, do a FaceTime, go back in the cave. So I don't think he thought he could leave. I think he was under the impression that the desert was just off limits.
Well, that's why I was wondering about the barrier thing, because I don't know. They must have mentioned it at some point in the early part of the film.
I think it was probably a reference to Buñuel's film, The Exterminating Angel.
Of course.
I think the filmmakers were trying to, that's what they were going for.
Yeah, I think that's that's what they were going for.
Everyone's favorite movie. We all know that one.
Yeah. Well, they definitely did when they were making this.
They probably did.
Probably.
Actually, no, that came out. Actually, The Exterminating Angel came out in 1962. So now I'm realizing that clearly The Exterminating Angel.
So who stole from who? Yeah.
It was. They were borrowing heavily from Robot Monster.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
The greatest movie of all time. Yeah.
It all makes sense now. So yeah, he strangles the young girl. So he informs the Great Guidance in another of his mission reports. Yes. I thought originally that he was just making it up and telling the Great Guidance that, like, he was getting a conscience, which he does sort of later on, but
It gets horny. No, I wouldn't say a conscience.
I guess not a conscience, but yeah. But we do see more of these physical means that Roman mentions earlier, where he attacks Roy and Alice, and these two lovebirds are still necking in the bushes in this scene too. And he captures Alice in true King Kong, Fay Wray fashion and makes off with her. And
yes. Picking her up. She gets picked up like 10 times in this movie.
Yeah. Towards the end, she definitely gets picked up a lot. And we also learn at this point that Roman is from the planet Roman, which makes sense.
Well, we don't understand Romanian. I guess that's what it would be.
Romanian. I don't think that's right.
We don't understand Romanian naming conventions.
True.
So it might be. Yeah.
Maybe they're all named Roman and.
It might be an I Am Groot situation. Yeah. Where there's something they know that just we don't get.
Exactly. It's how you say it.
Subtleties in the pronunciation.
Inflection. Yeah. Roman at this point, he does begin to feel emotions, especially toward Alice, we could say.
Ooh la la.
Yeah. I must, but I cannot.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the monologue.
Quote. Yeah. Unfortunately, I did not write down the entire monologue, which I probably should have. Mm-hmm. But there is, do you remember any more of it, Marley? I'm going to put you on the spot here, but there's some great lines in it.
I can't really remember the bulk of it, but it left my friend and I just repeating must and cannot. Yeah. But I must.
Yes.
In my notes, I wrote the word Shakespearean very big.
Yes. It's very Shakespearean.
Very Shakespearean.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yes. I there's so many small tidbits that would work so well in its isolated form. Mm-hmm. Like, I say this about a lot of movies today, that, like, if this were just a short film, or if this scene were just a short film, then it would be awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Like, I say that all the time, actually.
Yeah. About most DC movies, actually. Yeah. Like,
this could be at least an hour
scene.
Shorter. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. But, there's so many isolated good moments that I really do enjoy. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it might be the room kind of effect where ironic enjoyment turns into genuine enjoyment.
Yes.
But the must and cannot monologue had me both laughing, but also like hand to my heart, like nodding my head. Like, yes, you're right, man.
Although he does
get pretty creepy with Alice. Yeah, I don't see love. Yeah. I see more lust. Yeah.
But it is thought provoking. I was saying to Mark before we recorded, I recently watched The Man Who Fell to Earth for the first time. I don't know, Marley, if have you seen that movie or no?
I'm not familiar. I'm
David
sorry.
Bowie.
Well, if you like this one, you should. That's a good rec. but it kind of, awesome. You know, without giving anything away, kind of explores certain themes about, you know, a stranger in a strange land, adapting to the conventions of that strange land and coming to understand in a similar way to this, where it's like to someone, you know, to Roman, who doesn't understand how humans function at all, like very clearly to the point where he doesn't even know that he could strangle them, you know, after spending some time around them and kind of seeing the way that they function, kind of starting to adapt his behavior to that, mm-hmm. is like, even if he's adapting to kind of, you know, the worst aspects of humanity, is still pretty fascinating, you know, that kind of adaptation by osmosis, for lack of a better term.
See, thought-provoking film as well.
A little bit, yeah.
He does end his monologue with saying, "I cannot kill the girl, but I will kill the boy."
Mm-hmm.
So he's definitely going to kill another kid. It's going
to
happen.
Yes. He also does get quite creepy with Alice in this scene. I do have to admit, the weird choice, and I'm not here to say, like, shame on movie, because, you know, it's 50s, so grain of salt.
Yeah.
But the interesting choice of when Alice is in his captivity and she's tied up, and maybe it was just an odd direction in the scene that they didn't cut out or they just kept rolling, but he starts to rip off her dress, but then he just pops the collar and then leaves.
Oh, I think I missed that, actually.
Yeah, like her halter top, he just pops the collar off, and then he's like, that's it. And he just leaves to go FaceTime his homie. Like, he doesn't, nothing else.
He just pops the collar, that's it.
Like, he thinks that's the, like, the extent of intimacy. You know what I mean? Like,
that's how humans do it. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, neck. Oh.
In the 50s, that probably was, like, a huge
thing.
That's
true.
Yeah, I was going to say, I could see that being the director is kind of having one of these moments where they're like, this scene will play. And it's a B movie, so, you know, the people watching this are not going to be your mainstream nuclear family kind of people, you know, and they'll see that moment, which is as close as you realistically were getting to, like, nudity or a sex scene at that era, and they'll probably go tell all their friends about it, and they'll come see the movie, and we'll make our money back.
You see
her
neck!
I saw a collarbone! Yeah. Oh my god!
Collarbone! Gotta go see it. Yeah. It's pretty erotic, you know. It's pretty
in a kind of disturbing way.
Yeah,
pushing boundaries
and disturbing, yes. But yeah, so to kind of just conclude our talk of the film, the plot of the film itself. So at this point, Roman is destroyed. Roman and Johnny are both destroyed at the same moment by the Great Guidance, and not sure exactly how he did it, but. Possibly
you get the dinosaurs again.
So the dinosaurs return, the reptiles return. So I guess it's like the death ray, right, that he's using on Roman. And because the Great Guidance, seeing that Roman has failed, he decides to release the cosmic Q rays that will spawn these prehistoric reptiles. I love this whole description of like what will happen. That will spawn prehistoric reptiles that will devour whatever remains of life. Like, he's just telling you what's going to happen. And as this is accompanied by stop animation and taken from another film, I believe, again. So that sort of explains the fighting lizards scene at the beginning of the film, I guess, right?
Maybe it was foreshadowing, an artistic device.
There you go. Very artistic. very abstract. Yeah, so it kind of goes back to that type of montage there, and then everyone's alive. You just snap out of it. It was all a dream, or was it? Because everyone is now alive, having like a picnic, I guess, together. It still kind of looks like they're the last people on Earth, though. Like they're still, so everyone's still been annihilated.
It's a desert setting.
Or maybe they're just having a picnic in a desert. I'm not sure. Yeah, they kind of leave it up in the air, I guess, if it was all just little Johnny's dream, you know, or not. And but of course, we do have Roman himself emerging from the cave and
three times
in 3D. Yeah, three times. You counted too, because I actually counted how many times as well that he came out, because each time it was funnier.
He reemerged
from the cave.
Every time he came out, we like fake screamed, and then he came out again, and it was just cry laughing
over
and over. Magical moment.
Yes.
How can we pad out the last 2 minutes? Play it again.
Well, the audiences really got their money's worth with that 3D.
Because there was three
film.
Of them. Yeah.
3D. Yeah, three of them, and the way he's like, you know, putting his arms out, like coming at the audience. And,
ooh, we're gonna get you.
Yeah.
I think that also pushed the movie over the 1 hour mark, which was probably an important.
Yes,
definitely.
we needed that cap on.
They needed to hit the
That and the repeat of the dinosaur footage. Definitely.
Yes.
Yeah. Honestly, no, but like that legitimately
crucial.
Could have been a reason. Yeah. You know, if they might have had some distributor who was like, the movie needs to be an hour, or else people will complain about it.
And of course, we're like, oh, it's brilliant that they foreshadow and then return to it. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Which it is brilliant, but This whole movie is brilliant, and it feels like a fever dream. Me and Jeremy were saying before we started recording today that it's appropriate that the film ends with the "was it all a dream" kind of scenario, because it feels like a dream, this movie.
Absolutely.
And a beautiful dream. So thank you again, Marley, for exposing us to this robot monster film.
It really was like seeing this, because I saw that for the first time in a theater, and it really was a magical experience just having groups of people that, like, I imagine in the 50s maybe got a little scared, maybe a few gasps, but in this modern day when I saw it in the theater, just like laughter. It was insane, wonderful, beautiful laughter.
I'm sure, yeah.
And I hope you don't mind, but I'd like to share my notes. I only took a few, so it won't take that long.
Oh, please, yes.
But I noted that at the very top of the movie, with that comic book spread sort of background under the opening credits, the only visible words are fear and terror. So they really are setting the mood for the rest of the film. They're telling you how to feel. My next note, why is that old man in the cave holding the boy so tightly? He's sitting on his lap. And that's not his father. It is revealed that before the nap and after the nap, in what seems to be the real world, they're just two random scientists. And then at the end of the movie, they like flirt, like, oh, why don't you come out to dinner? And then all of the romance stuff is a dream. Or, you know, or is it, like, at the very end reveal. But that's that thing explained. But a good line delivery was Johnny going, here we are in the cave. I repeated that for the rest of the night.
That's a good
fun
one.
Fact,
I actually missed that one.
That actor, the of Johnny, he is the only living cast member to this day.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
But best cut in the world is them taking a nap right after lunch.
Yes.
Real life alligator with a triceratops flap on its back? ? Roman and his species is responsible for nuclear warfare? Because they did play stock footage of bombs and houses blowing up. my favorite line, you must kill yourselves. And then skipping to the end, a note in the middle I took is little girl just shows up again, because the daughter, or the young kid sister, she is not in, or like all the segments that are in this dystopian future, she's not in it until a decent chunk.
Yeah.
She shows up in the family FaceTime, but she doesn't actually like make any appearances beforehand. She's just in the shot, but you never actually see her like around the house.
Oh.
Yeah.
I missed that as well.
It's very interesting.
Well, you've seen this film probably how many times now?
I think this yesterday was my third time watching.
Okay.
But my last major note was epilepsy warning. Please take caution. I do not get affected by that, but people who watch it, definitely. I'm sure there's someone. There's a lot of strange flashing.
Yeah.
Yes.
True.
They had to intercut it between footage of him just walking through the desert. Like, wow, what do we do visually? Epilepsy. I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Like, parts of it are kind of psychedelic almost. Yeah. This film.
A little
the
bit.
Elements of it. Yeah.
It almost gave me like Twin Peaks: The Return vibes at times. But like.
Wow.
But like not. But like not like the. The not finely good. Crafted
not
art
in,
house
not
version,
good.
But just kind
not
of
intentional. Yeah.
No, but because you know, obviously, like The Return was referencing a lot of this stuff, particularly like
that's
the,
true,
the
yeah.
one episode of The Return that's all black and white. Like,
right.
I would not be surprised if this was a movie that was looked at.
Yeah,
in the
probably.
You know
possibly.
Research at least from a production design and
If David Lynch said that, he's like, oh, my favorite movie's Robot Monster, I would believe him.
Oh, yeah.
Like, yeah.
Well, if he said that,
sense.
There would be a major reappraisal of this movie.
Oh, for sure.
For sure. It would become like an art house.
Yeah, because...
an avant-garde classic.
Because honestly, I mean, look, I mean, this is Cult Movie Cult. We discussed a lot of cult films on this on the show, and this one really flew under the radar. Like, it's really not discussed much at all, which is part of the reason why... your project, Marley, is so exciting, which I guess this is a good segue into that. So we've discussed the film. Do you want to talk about the project or whatever you can discuss about it?
So I teased at it a little bit earlier, but the folks who restored this movie into fabulous home video 3D, and I say home video, but I like Blu-ray, that kind of thing, they have been putting together a graphic novel project, which is a a tribute to the movie, its legacy, the movie itself, its behind the scenes, that kind of thing. And it's a huge compilation of a bunch of artists together. It's one big anthology, so there would be a bunch of different short stories, and the artists and writers get to like decide what it is about. Some of them are retellings of like the plot of the movie. Some of them are like in real life, like fan encounters. It's all this like wonderful stuff, just kind of paying tribute to the movie. I'm very lucky to be on it. It is, I'm credited as introducing Marley Starr because it is one of my first big projects. Mm-hmm. And I say one of, let's put a pin in that. but there's a lot of incredible people working on it. Paul Castiglia, who he's running the project, but he's a former editor at Archie Comics.
Oh, cool.
And yeah, he has a huge passion for this kind of stuff. I feel like you guys would all get along. There's also Owen Klein, I believe his name is. He worked, he directed A24's Funny Pages, which is a really great movie. And someone else who's really interesting, his name is Carl Scheckel. He's 16 and he runs a website. I believe it's called Carl's Comics. I maybe should have looked it up before I talked about it. forgive me as I open a new tab.
That's okay.
But he was known in the comics community for being this really young kid who got to interview these legends. I feel like he actually got to sit down with like Steve Ditko, I believe.
Wow.
So even as a 16-year-old, he's now like writing, and he's a really great kid. And there's tons of great people on this. I'm very lucky to be a part of it. We just got fully funded on Kickstarter like a day ago.
Wow.
It was
a big
deal. Yeah. Thank That's you. Great. So it's actually, you know, it's happening. It's in motion, but I don't know when this will be out, but I do believe there's still like a week. The limit is the 9th for when people can still contribute. So if anyone is interested to look up the Robot Monster graphic novel between now and May 9th, 2024, you still can fund it and then get your hands on a signed copy if you're interested. So that's how this was all brought together, how, you know, I learned about this movie. And if anyone out there is interested in reading the final product when it comes out, then you will see me doing a little, you know, I'm not going to spoil it. You know, you're going to see me doing something. How about that?
Yeah.
How about you go find out?
Exactly. Yeah. You have to find out. And I mean, it's the gift that keeps on giving. Like, you found out about this film from this project, and then now we found out about the film and now we're telling hopefully some more people that are listening to this. And, it's again, very little talked about, little seen film. At least as far as what I was able to discern from just looking up information about it and things like that.
I think the fact that we
never even heard of it, really.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, like, because you and I, Mark, are both, at least I wouldn't say we're super, super deep in this era of filmmaking, but we're deep enough that it would have come across one of our radars.
Exactly.
If it was like, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But now it has, and it will hopefully continue to come across more people's radar.
For sure. Now, and to you guys, who are, I would say, seasoned professionals, would this count as a creature feature, do you feel? Or not really?
I would say so.
I feel like there's, like, that fine line between alien film and creature feature, where it's, like, sometimes it can cross over and sometimes it can't. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's about the creature, I guess,
but
this film.
I think so.
Yeah. I think it could pass. It's a lot of things, this film. It's very, you know... Just to talk about it in context with like other similar films of the time, I mean, it's very, very prototypical of the time, but it also stands out as very much its own thing. I think that's what's so cool about it. It's very unique, and which is why I think it works so well as a cult film. It's really a bit of an oddity. I mean, do you both think that it's unique in how low budget it is, or
I'd say so.
Yeah.
I mean, because I guess a lot of films at the time were probably low budget, but this is very low budget. I did write down a number here. So a budget of $20,000.
Oh, wow.
It was very lucrative, this film, which is at the time when it came out, maybe because of the 3D.
The collarbone.
I don't know. and the collarbone, of course.
The collarbone, yeah.
But it had a box office of more than $1 million. On a budget of
$20,000.
So someone got rich off this. They got like
like
$1 million in 1953 money. That's like pretty serious.
That's massive.
Yeah.
That's like,
and I mean, the film does have some notoriety, I'm sure. Like, some people are aware of it, but in 1984, actually MTV showed the film in its original 3D format, which is very interesting. I think that's the year I believe that's the year that MTV started. I could.
I wonder
wrong.
How they did that. Like, did they send people 3D glasses?
They actually offered 3D viewing glasses by mail order ahead of the broadcast date.
That's really cool.
Interesting.
So it was like a very coordinated thing. Yeah. So this movie, of all movies, maybe because it was even at that time public domain, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
Well, you know, as much as movies made for $20,000 are notorious for having great legal teams. You know, they may have let this one slip into the public domain.
Yeah. Oops. Yeah. Whoops. How'd they let this one get away? I don't know.
Oh, geez. I imagine it's like someone just was like, we don't care about this movie. And then like a day after, some executive is running around like, where'd you leave it? Where's the movie?
Where's
the
Robot Monster?
No!
Well, I mean, that's how It's a Wonderful Life has become a classic. So maybe this one's just kind of a slow burn. You know, on its way.
That's true.
I mean, obviously, we mentioned Ed Wood earlier, and I would say this is very much in the same league as his films, same vein. Even more so than, like, a lot of the other atomic sci-fi movies at the time. So I think, you know, again, it has that niche quality to it. And that's really all I had to say about Robot Monster. That's the end of my notes. But did you two have any other concluding thoughts before we mention our other collaboration, Marley?
I think it's going to get Best Picture this year.
Yeah, this year, like
2024. This is going to run out of options.
I do have a few kind of two concluding thoughts. So one is going back to the intermission thing, which I don't know if our little discussion on that will end up in the final episode or not. But I was saying before, the version I watched did have an intermission. I found it. It's at the 31-minute mark. So pretty much exactly halfway through the movie.
That's incredible.
However, upon a quick search as to why, because I couldn't find it in the movie and was trying to just see if anyone else had watched it or if I had just if I had dreamt it like our main character.
Fever dream again.
But what's actually really cool, if you two, I'm happy to send both of you the link, and if we can share it anywhere. So the intermission was actually in there. Apparently there was an intermission in all 3D movies from that era because something about the way it was shown, they needed to switch some things around technically. So all it normally came, I'm reading, at least this is what this one guy says on Letterboxd. He could be full of it.
this one guy.
But he seems like he knows what he's talking about. But what he's saying is the films were shown in polarized 3D on two projectors with interlocked 35mm prints. The largest reels available at the time were 24-inch, which could accommodate up to 5,000 feet of color film and 5,500 feet of black and white. So it seems like because of the type of projection, they essentially ran out of film that they could project and needed to switch it out. So that's kind of cool because I didn't know that. Next note, the intermission slide also has the comic books in the background, and it has some other comic book covers. At least I'm not remembering the initial one off the top of my head, but it has a comic book called Another World, Space Cadet, one called Robot Monster, and then you see Fear, Strange Suspense. Yes. So you see a lot of them in this intermission slide, which is pretty cool.
That is cool.
So that's worth checking out. And then the final note I have to end this, we were just talking about David Lynch before, and his kind of you know, because even down
he gets brought up a lot on the show.
Even in this surprised. Down to the obviously the 1950s America, the kind of challenging of the nuclear family, the dream idea. Like, there are a lot of kind of very Lynchian elements in this, which brings me to something that I kind of just realized as we were talking here, which is very, very strange. And I didn't think about it all watching the movie because it kind of ended so quickly. But once we realize that this was a small boy's dream, it gets very weird.
Oh, yeah.
like
especially all the necking.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, like this kid is... Because she was his older sister. Or did I completely misread that?
No, you got that right.
Yeah,
that's
so
his sister.
So there's this young boy having dreams about his sister, like getting it on with an older man who this kid knows, and then basically being like sexually abused by a monster, which is very weird. So I don't know. I would be curious to watch this movie again and kind of go at it with like a Freudian lens. And
his younger sister getting strangled.
His younger sister. So this kid, you know, this isn't the kind of dream that a kid that age is probably normally having because they just don't those aren't images that they would be coming across in their everyday
lives.
The mass
extinction of humans as well.
Yeah. And also
it does explain the dinosaurs.
This kid is also.
It does explain the dinosaurs.
Kids do love it. But also this kid is like living apparently on some kind of commune in the desert or something. Like, it doesn't really give us context. So I'm definitely reading into it too much here. I don't think
not at all.
I don't think these were the intentions of the filmmakers, but you know, from the point of view of, you know, as artists, when we make art, we kind of reveal what's on our mind, you know, even if we don't necessarily mean to. It'd just be an interesting rewatch to just look at the whole thing strictly thinking about like this kid's life and what might be pushing him circumstantially to be thinking about these things and have seen these kind of things in his life where they could end up in his dream. Like, I don't know. It maybe paints a kind of darker, creepier story.
I love that interpretation, Jeremy. I do feel like it was just to get the extra 2 minutes on at the end, probably.
Yeah.
But I love the way you're thinking about it.
I don't know. It might have just been for the extra 2 minutes, but it's in the movie. It's in the movie, so it's canon. So we have to approach it from that point of view. And it's like, it has some dark undertones when you really think about it like that.
Has it added to your repeated viewings, Marley, like when you think of it in that way?
It was definitely a note I took last night. I think in the middle of that that making out montage in the brush, it was something that I thought about. Like,
why is little Johnny thinking about
this? Yeah, the dinosaurs, I get it. 10-year-old boys love that kind of thing. Even gorilla the destruction suit, of the world by, like, gorilla suit, scuba helmet makes sense. But, like, even the destruction of the world at a point, like, I can see a kid thinking about that, but like from his frame of reference, he met this scientist man maybe in his 30s and then dreamt about him having premarital sex.
Shirtless. Constantly shirtless,
chest bush flowing in the wind. Yeah. It's
a lot to unpack here. Yeah.
That's true. Yeah. There's also the homoerotic angle here. There's really, like, I don't know. There's some pretty fascinating, you know. When it comes from the perspective of this kid thinking about all this stuff, it just takes on a really different...
He might be exploring his desires.
Yeah, see? Who knows? It's so...
Thought-provoking, this film. It's so many things. But it's all the things that it is pretty entertaining to watch. So thank you very much again, Marley, for bringing this to our attention.
So we
can discuss it on the show. And also, we should probably mention that you are the illustrator of a comic book that we are working on together.
Yay! Yes, I
am.
I'm so excited to
talk mentioning
about
it. Yay! I'm super excited about it. It's a superhero parody called Slightly Altered Man. And we have, I guess, sort of released the first issue, not officially yet.
A soft drop.
Yeah, soft drop. Unofficial releasing of the first issue, but the first issue is completed. We are working now on the second issue, so hopefully, you know, we'll get at least a few issues, like a series going. But I'm super happy with everything you've done so far, Marley. I mean, everything looks amazing.
Likewise.
So I can't wait for people to see it, and I know you've been like throwing just a little bit out on Instagram and things like that, just some images of it. But I can't wait for people to finally be able to see it. And thanks for being part of that. I really appreciate it.
Of course. I mean, it's such a fun project. And, like, I'm sure if people are listening to this, then they, you know, they're going to venture out and look at the other projects you've worked on. So I'm not sure how much I have to sell it here. But if I'm going to be honest.
You
got
to sell it. No, I'm just kidding.
Please. But in reality, it really is such a clever story. As I draw comics, I also read them feverishly. I'm always in the middle of something. Right now, I'm in the middle of reading Jeff Smith's Bone, trying to get through all of it.
I've actually read all of that.
Yeah. Oh, it's worth really
it.
Good.
It's worth
very,
it.
Very very nostalgic for granted a time I wasn't in, but it feels like when I was a kid and I watched The Princess Bride and they bring out some strange element and I'm like, yeah, of course that makes sense.
Oh, yeah.
This kind of
it
story.
Has that feel for sure, yeah.
Yeah, I'm definitely getting that. But I'm always trying to read something and I can say with somewhat confidence I'm familiar with comics and I've read a lot. So having read this script, I really did instantly fall in love with it. Super clever, very funny. And I tried to bring my A game because... half the battle is how they look. The other half to falling in love with these characters is the way they're written. And, you know, for you, dear listener at home, I think we nailed it because Mark's a great writer and I don't think I'm too shabby with the drawings. So, go read
it. You are definitely not too shabby. Thank you very much for saying that. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I think it all came together really well, and again, just can't wait for people to see it. So we'll give updates on that as it progresses. But yeah, thanks for being a part of the show too. I mean, it was great to watch this movie and talk about it with you.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. This was a blast. I'm sorry if I cut anybody off. I'm just too darn excited about that robot monster.
Oh, no, don't worry. It happens all the time. Yeah, it's what happens when you see a robot monster, a Ro-Man.
Yes, a Ro-Man for my human.
Yeah, I'll be quoting this movie for a very long time, I'm sure.
Oh my God, yeah.
Very quotable. But yeah, that's basically it. Did you have any parting thoughts or anything, Marley? Do you want to mention about Robot
Parting thoughts?
Monster?
Yes. This won't make sense to the listeners, but right now in this call, I don't have a camera, so I have to confess to you guys, I'm actually a 7-foot man in a gorilla suit with a scuba helmet.
I knew it.
Like a
I knew it.
I'm sorry. You guys had to trust me first. I'm sorry.
It is very meta that we're doing this on a video call.
That's true.
Wait, is this a dream? Is this all a dream?
Oh my God, there's iguanas.
Look, iguanas. I knew it. That means it's a dream.
That's how every dream begins and ends, with alligators killing each other and iguanas.
Mm-hmm. Foreshadowing, yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And somewhere there's two poor guys in a spaceship who just...
Yeah.
They don't know what the hell.
I know.
Rest
so bad
in peace to those two guys.
Yeah.
Can we give like a shout out? Like if there's some type of a little award show we can do, those guys can get like honorable mention.
Two guys. Yeah.
Spaceship fellows. Mm-hmm.
Spaceship fellows. Rest in peace. Jeremy, how about you? Any parting thoughts about Robot Monster here?
No, I think we basically covered everything I had made my notes on. It's just I'm glad thank you, Marley, for like Mark said, for coming on the show and for introducing us to this movie.
Yeah.
Anytime. Any weird movie, if I find it, you guys will be the first to know.
Awesome. Yeah, we don't do many one off episodes, but this one seemed very appropriate for it. So
yes, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again for being part of the show, and thanks everyone for listening to Cult Movie Cult. You can find us on all the usual social media. If you have any cult films you'd like to hear us discuss on the show, or if you'd like to officially join the cult, as Marley has done, and be a guest on the show, please feel free to reach out to us at cultmoviecult@gmail.com. This has been Cult Movie Cult, and until next time, so long from the other side.